Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I'd like to share with you a special episode of 10,000 Things. In September of 2022, KUOW Public Radio celebrated the first season of our podcast with a live event at McCall Hall at the Seattle Center. Back then, our podcast was called The Blue Suit. We evolved to become 10,000 Things, but we had the same goal of telling compelling stories behind modern-day artifacts of Asian American life. In our special live show, you're going to hear interviews from some of our previous guests on the podcast, as well as some new stories. And musician Tomo Nakayama joins us to share a story about an object that is dear to his heart and to play a few songs, plus a few other surprises. I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks, everyone, for being here tonight. Welcome to the end of our season celebration for The Blue Suit. I'm Shinyi Pai, host and creator of the podcast The Blue Suit. I created The Blue Suit out of a desire to tell more stories about Asian Americans in the media during a time when our communities experienced a huge uptick in anti-Asian hate crimes. I wanted the stories that The Blue Suit shared to provide humanizing, culturally specific stories about people who shatter the myth of the Asian American model minority identity. Stories that would have made a difference to me when I was a young person growing up between cultures. I wanted stories that could express and make visible that there's more than one way to be Asian. Stories that would remind me that we are our ancestors' dreams. Tonight, we'll have a chance to visit with several guests from our first season. We'll reflect on Asian American identities with Anita Yu Ali, the creator of The Red Chador, and hear from Tomo Nakayama about one of his favorite objects. Our show tonight will include film, storytelling, and music, and listener stories from you, our audience. We're going to kick things off with a conversation about objects and collections with Jessica Rubenacher. Jessica Rubenacher is the exhibits director for the Wing Luke Asian Museum. She received a master's degree in museology or the study of museums in 2009 and has worked with public art and museum collections for more than a decade. She's also a collector of objects. Her largest collection is a collection of more than 365 houseplants, and she curated the plants for our event tonight. Jessica is featured in episode 2 of The Blue Suit, in which we talk about a special plant that she cultivated from clippings, the night-blooming cereus.
The evening that the cereus started to bloom, it was a midsummer night.
It formed a bud, and I just kept watching it. Like, I didn't want to miss the big show, so I just kept monitoring it. We might have also been going on vacation. Like, we were planning to go away for the weekend, and I was like, totally ready to cancel the trip. I will say, when it finally opened, it was just really fragrant. It was far more fragrant than I thought it might be. Kind of smelled like maybe gardenia, but it filled like the whole room. Like, I could just smell this queen of the night. And then in the morning, it was completely closed. It was very magical.
Please welcome Jessica Rubenacher. Hi. So let's talk about plants. What did you bring with you today?
Well, I didn't end up bringing the Queen of the Night with me. I think she might have some sort of fungus, or I'm nursing her back to health, and hopefully she'll be blooming again. But I brought some larger plants that are flanking us. That's the Hoya pubicalyx, which I'll actually be giving out cuttings after the events in the lobby. So if anyone is interested, I actually received that plant as a gift. It was already 20 years old, and a friend who had made in the plant community was just like, hey, do you want this plant? I don't have room for it. And I'm like, yeah, I want that plant. So I'd love to share it with anyone in the audience who's interested. I even brought my pruning shears, so I mean business. So that's one of my first Hoya. Which a large part of my collection, my plant collection, are Hoya. And then on the end here, I have the staghorn fern, which is actually my husband's plant. He has three plants in our house, and he's responsible for, they're all ferns, and he's responsible for watering the staghorn fern. And then I have, I also brought the rubbered plant, which I think we chatted about in the podcast, that reminds me a lot of my grandmother, because she had a huge rubber tree that she would decorate and use as her Christmas tree. She would put lights on it and had this really great like tulle Filipino butterfly on it. Like, I have very vivid memories of her rubber plant.
I'm so glad that you brought all these beautiful specimens tonight. So you're an exhibition designer by profession who works with collections on a regular basis. Why do you think people like to collect things?
Well, I can at least speak personally. I know for a lot of my collections, I started collecting things for nostalgic reasons. I was thinking about this the other day. My family immigrated from the Philippines, and in the 50s, my grandfather worked for the Philippine consulate. And I think when they immigrated, they weren't necessarily thinking they'd be staying in the States for so long. So they didn't really bring a lot of like family heirlooms. So we don't really have a lot of those family heirlooms. Those stayed back in the Philippines. And so for me, you know, when I stumbled upon the Pyrex that we used as a kid, you know, like when I found that at Goodwill, that kind of became like a family heirloom for me. These things that brought back memories of my family and childhood, and memories from you know, people who are no longer here. So I think there's a bit of nostalgia involved. I think too, you know, working in a museum, at least at the Wing Luke Museum, what's really important is that story that accompanies an object. So we'll often have artifacts on display, but we'll always try when we can to include that first-person narrative, you know, the oral history of someone speaking about that object and why it's significant to them personally. And that's really the interesting thing to me. I think it brings that object to life, hearing firsthand why it's important to someone.
Absolutely. It gives it a voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we know that you collect plants, and you've mentioned Pyrex. Are there other things that you collect?
Globes. Ever since I was a kid, I was really interested in maps and geography. I think I won a geography bee when I was in like sixth grade. And so I've just had this really, this fascination with globes. And it's interesting to try to date them based on these like shifts in geopolitical borders, and also just some really cool designs. Like, there's some really cool mid-century globes in my collection. So we have a lot of globes, but we have a one-in, one-out policy right now, because they kind of take up a lot of space. So so it's kind of on hold right now, the globe collection. I did also recently, I was cleaning out our basement, and I came across my childhood sticker collection. I had this purple box, and it says Jessica's stickers on it. And it was filled with like Lisa Frank stickers, like all still on the sheets, because I like always had this anxiety about, you know, where I would place them. So I just hoarded them. And now I have all of these like stickers from the 80s and 90s still.
Yeah, you don't want them to lose their stick, right? Right? If you put them in an album. Yeah.
Then what? Yeah. So vintage. I have this sticker collection.
Nice. Yeah. What do you think separates an object in your own home that has meaning from an object in a museum?
Well, I do think about the, you know, some artifacts or objects are just functional, right? Like there might be this bowl that your Pyrex bowl that you're using every day to bake with, and then all of a sudden it's on display in a museum behind glass and you're not able to use it for its original function. And there's something interesting about that. I know for like my Pyrex, there's like, it reminds me of like my grandmother. I have a, the same print that my step-grandmother had. And so there's something special about being able to continue to use it in that same function and being able to connect with it personally. There's still that wonderful story that you're able to learn in a museum when you hear about someone else's object and story that accompanies it, but still something special about being able to use it for that original function.
Do you use the Pyrex? Do you make casseroles or other things?
I do. I have specific sets that I use for day-to-day and then other for display. Because I'm very clumsy, so I don't want anything to happen to the special Pyrex.
It's a backup set.
Yeah. Backup set, yeah.
Thank you so much for being a guest on season one. And as Jessica mentioned, after the event in the lobby, she'll be giving away clippings of this beautiful Hoya Puba Calyx in the lobby. You can follow Jessica on Instagram at Let's Be Fronds, F-R-O-N-D-S. Thanks so much. Anita Yu Ali is a performance artist, faculty at UW-Bothell, and a global agitator. We'll be taking questions from the audience for Anita, so if you'd like to write down a question for her on a note card, KUOW staff will be walking around the room collecting your cards. Anita was featured in episode 1 of The Blue Suit. Tonight, she's here to talk about the red chador, the hand-stitched garment that Anita wears during performances around the world that celebrate Muslim American identity.
When I presented the red chador in America for the very first time, I don't think I was as prepared to receive the kind of profanity that was tossed at me and the fear.
Anita would walk as the red chador on the streets in Hartford, Connecticut.
Students would yell out profanity or would start shaking. You would physically see students like having some kind of anxiety attack. And this is a woman that's dressed in red sequins.
She didn't realize that her audiences had been a generation of young people who had grown up with 9/11 and been subject to strong anti-Islamic bias in the media. Anita also performed in Washington, D.C.
The reactions to the work in the Smithsonian space was really profound for me.
At the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center, she was surrounded by a sea of 99 American flags while standing on a raised platform in the red chador.
There was a man who was just dressed in like a pink polo shirt and a pair of pants and had a backpack on. He was a very tall, big built man. And he stuck around for a long time, just kind of going back and forth and looking. And then the director of the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center was there and approached the man. And the man ended up being like a plainclothes Marine officer who said to her, "This is so powerful. Thank you very much for putting this on. This is why I put on the uniform and I have been stationed in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And it's so important that we celebrate what America is about, this kind of diversity."
Please welcome Anita Yu Ali.
Hi.
Hi. Tell me about the cultural significance of the Chador or the Malaysian Telekung. What does it mean to you? And what's your relationship to this religious garment?
Well, I mean, I grew up very Orthodox Muslim, and my family's been Muslim for generations. And so the prayer garment is very important. It's when we're in front of God or when we're in our ritualistic prayers, we have the tradition of wearing a prayer garment. And ours are usually white, and they're handmade. They're usually stitched. They're passed down from your grandparents, your grandmother, your mother. They're embroidered, and you wear it as a two-piece prayer garment. It completely covers your hair. It's very long and drapey. And then you enact prayers with it. And so you don't know it as the Chador, and as Americans or the more popular imagination of the Chador, that didn't really come into, you know, media headlines until all these various wars that have been waged in and around the Middle East. So for me, you know, of course, I, when creating these pieces, gave it a name that was playing off of a more recognized name than the Telekung, which is what Malays use.
I'm really curious a little bit about the fabrication of the piece. Like, you know, how long did it take you to make, and how heavy is it?
So first, what you're looking at is an exhibition version. This is one of two, and these have been remade because the very original one-of-a-kind garment has been lost. My last trip in Tel Aviv, Israel, it was taken from me. So what you're looking at is, after a year of fully mourning the loss of this work, coming to terms with that loss and then pulling yourself together to rebirth this project. This one is very heavy because I couldn't match the same sequence. By this time, 5 years had passed since I had first made the garment. And so going back to the markets of Cambodia, I couldn't find the same sequent material. I also went to Thailand and Vietnam to look for the right red sequins. And so I was able to find two sets. This one, which I loved so much, but it's very heavy. This thing is maybe 30 to 40 pounds. So imagine wearing it and doing a durational piece for like 6 to 8 hours on a hot beach in Honolulu. Yeah, it's a different kind of, you know, godliness. So I have a second version that is a performance version that's much lighter, but the sequins aren't as pretty, but you won't be able to tell in a photograph or from a distance. And so I have that version, which has gotten wet in the ocean. It's gotten sand all over it. It's gone through some things.
So how is being in the world as the Red Chador different than being in the world as Anita U. Ali?
Oh, boy. We talk about this in therapy. I've said this in interviews, too. There's something about wearing a garment like this, you know, that has the sparkliness, the sequence, of course, if you imagine an evening gown or a ball gown or a debutante gown, there's a regalness, you know, there's a sense of such length. And so you kind of pull yourself up a little bit more because you are embodying a character. And for me, it's very obvious in all of my personas in various performances, but for this one, when I put it on, you automatically feel like, okay, I am someone else. I mean, Anita is there. Anita is the performer, but this is something much bigger than myself because of its representation, because of its suggestion to kind of many other geopolitical moments that I'm alluding to.
Do you want to talk about joy at all?
Joy. we're all looking for, you know, some kind of joy, and I think that those of us who have an activism in our work also understand the role of love in it. Like, you're speaking out on these things and or about these things or bringing difficult conversations to the surface, because in the end, you know, you love your community, your people, and the world. You're trying to bring something different and honorable, you know, to some things that are really ugly and grotesque and dark, and bring out an uglier side of humanity. And of course, I experience it with the performances, but I don't know if that answers your question.
What are some of the more extreme reactions from the public that you've experienced while wearing the red jador?
Extreme. Let's see. I think the taking away of the garment, which didn't even come out for a performance, that to me was pretty violent. But also other moments besides, you know, people's usual sort of side eye or saying horrible things like, you know, you're triggering my PTSD. I was in Afghanistan. Get away from me or I'm going to clobber you. There was one person in San Francisco who ran after myself and my documentarian with a windshield wiper blade and was going to attack me until my documentarian said, "Anita." And, you know, just I looked at him. And then there was a cyclist who randomly came at that moment chasing this man off. So that happened. It's a lot of actually horrible threats of physical violence happened in San Francisco for that durational performance. But I think that was the worst of it. Usual sort of, you know, hate mail, hateful things that have been said or commented on.
So after all these years of performing as the red jador, what do you feel like the red jador has taught you?
What has it taught me? I think that it's definitely taught me that her time wasn't over. I think the easier thing would have been to say, okay, the garment is gone. It was a one of a kind. She's done, right? Somebody could have easily have maybe said, okay, you know, even God has pulled the switch on her. You know, she's done. Give it up. Start something new. But I think I wasn't done with it quite yet. And so that's the complexity of these performances when you embody a persona, is the balance of Anita the artist and then allowing the performance persona to have a wider narrative. Because I actually don't know her full story until she's taken out to the streets on exhibition, interacting. That is when the story sort of unfolds. So I may be able to put some things into place and facilitate some kind of, you know, hope and series of ways to kind of imagine what the story might be, but it doesn't show itself until the actual interactivity and public interaction with the work.
I'd love to have a look at audience questions, if any were submitted to Kamna or Charlotte. Where did any come in? Or is there anybody in the audience who might be interested in asking a question? I see a hand back there. There is a microphone up here. If you would like to come down and speak your question, or you could yell it. Yeah, you could yell it, and we can repeat it.
Thank you. I just wanted to find out how long, obviously you made the garments by hand. How long did it take to create the garments?
Oh, how long? Well, I don't do it by myself. I can sew, but I can't sew that well. So I actually have a sewing studio. It's an organization called Friends International in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where I was based for 5 years and where I still go back and forth. And those folks have been making my work. They actually are a social entrepreneur organization that works with street kids and folks who are economically deprived. And so they are taught crafts. And so one of the things that they do is a sewing workshop. And so I get a lot of my stuff made there, but it's a whole process. There's a lot of back and forth. And so I would say it takes them, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks probably to fully make it and to, you know, have it be fitted properly.
Thank you.
Yes, Kristen Young.
I was wondering how the experience of having the garment taken from you and then remaking it and then bringing it back out again and going through all of this story that you're talking about, how has it influenced the making that you're doing now and what you are working on for the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the rebirth was a result of a commissioning residency with the Shangri-La Islamic Museum of Art, Culture, and Design in Honolulu. And so their faith and support to kind of manifest this rebirth of the work made the new vision happen. So I kind of knew that to remake this, it can't be reinvented in the same exact way. Like, she died, you know? So if she was to be rebirthed, it needs to be something even bigger and maybe even as epic as the way she left. And so the new work, she is no longer alone. What you're seeing is just one garment. There are actually six others, a rainbow chador. It's a spectrum of various colored chadors. And the idea behind that work, it's called Genesis One. And she now never walks alone. She is always with the accompaniment of other chadoras, of other bodies who are standing in solidarity to her. And so each one is a different color. And it's also my interest in aligning issues of Islamophobia with homophobia. I think that we can't just talk about the things that are so specific to our community without recognizing other issues that are as important and that have relevance. And so this is my way of thinking through the complexities that are embedded in all very religious communities, that we need to address those issues that inside our community, as well as the other issues that are coming at our community. And so this new version, you see this colorful spectrum of the chadors, and the whole vision is there'll be 99 of them, and so there'll be like an army of very colorful, brightly lit sequin chadors that are kind of taking over a space and a site.
Maybe time for one more question for Anita. Anyone else in the audience? I see a hand over.
Oh my gosh, there's a little girl. Okay, yes, Hannah. Yes, you're giving it away, daughter. Yes.
Why did the chador get taken away again?
Oh, why did it get taken away again? Well, I like to think that it was a closeted immigration officer, a closeted immigration officer at the Tel Aviv airport that really was envious of mommy's garment and is now appearing in different dance clubs with mommy's garment in his fabulous self.
Thank you.
Thank but you. The other answer is they wanted to silence your mother.
Thank you for that question, Hannah. So Anita is going to have a retrospective exhibition at the Seattle Asian Art Museum next year in 2023. So that's something to look forward to. Anita, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Shirley.
Tomo Nakayama is an internationally known singer and songwriter. He also wrote the theme music for The Blue Suit. In episode three, he chatted with me about the Japanese ingredient of miso, his love for the Netflix show Midnight Diner, and becoming a better cook during pandemic.
Miso is a basic ingredient in Japanese cooking made of soybeans that have been ground and fermented. It comes in red, brown, and white varieties, which all vary in complexity, age, and taste.
People who are really into it, they can tell what part of the country it's from by the flavor, or they'll identify really strongly with it. That's their like childhood flavor. And so everybody claims that theirs is the best.
This specificity of taste is something Tomo remembers from a trip to visit his family in Kochi, the region in southern Japan where he was born.
My cousin's wife said that when she first married into the family's rice didn't taste right to her because she came from the mountains, and the family that she married into, they lived by the ocean. So like just from being so close to the salt water, there's just like a slight amount of salt in the flavor of the rice, which like I wouldn't be able to tell, you know. But like she said, yeah, I don't, it took me years to get used to that flavor.
So subtle.
Yeah, it's so subtle. And in Japan, they call it kodawari. It's just, it shows care for each ingredient and like where it comes from and how it was grown.
Please welcome Tomo Nakayama.
How's your knee?
Hi.
This chair is very tall.
Tomo, thank you so much for being with us tonight. On the first season of The Blue Suit, we sat down to have a conversation about the flavors of childhood and ended up making an episode around miso paste, a common ingredient in Japanese cooking. But I wanted to invite you to talk to me today about a favorite object from your own personal collections. What did you bring with you?
So I thought about bringing a tub of miso, but it felt kind of silly. Like, I got this at a Wajimaya over 2 weeks ago. So, but one of the things that I talked about in the episode, well, it didn't make it into the final episode, but one of the memories I have of miso was this squid miso salad that my grandmother used to make in Kochi. And she was my favorite person in the whole world. And she passed away years ago, but the last time I visited her house in Kochi, it's in the mountainside and way out in the countries, I found her old abacus that she used to use. It just meant a lot to me. It was just in a pile in a box of her old things. And I asked my aunt if I could keep it, and she was surprised. You know, she was like, oh, this old thing, yeah, you can have it. But I just remember visiting her in the summertime, and she had this next to, you know, every home used to have a rotary phone station. And this was next to her phone, and I remember seeing her just adding things up, and I never learned how to use it, but I just, just the memory of her fingers, you know, clicking away at this thing, and just being able to hold it, and I remember her, you know, her hands, you know, it, yeah, it just means a lot to me, so.
I think there's a great comfort in objects that loved ones have handled, that we know that they've touched in some way, and then they come to us. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to turn to talking about music a little bit. You've composed music for film projects like Lynn Shelton's Touchy Feely and other films, and you know, we commissioned you to make the music for this radio show. I'd love to hear you talk about the experience of composing music for collaborations.
Yeah, it's each project is really different, and I was really honored to be able to compose music for this series. And you know, oftentimes, I do a lot of composing for like commercials and you know, corporate projects and stuff, where often they'll give us reference tracks or other songs that they want it to sound like, you know. But I really appreciated that that you and KOW, they you asked me to just be myself, just make music that sounds like my music, you know. And the only note I got was like, please don't make it overtly Asian. like don't put any gongs in.
That was my note. I said, no air fuel, no gongs.
Yeah. But I was like, well, I mean, I'm making it, so it's probably going to sound Asian. But I really loved working on it, and just the it's so rare to be able to have stories that we can relate to, you know, that that really resonate with me on a personal level. So I felt like I was able to put a lot of my own self and my tastes, and especially the feeling I get from traveling to Japan and you know, old Japanese movies that I love, like Studio Ghibli and like Joe Hisaishi, all those soundtracks. And so I think I referenced that a lot in the writing of the music.
Well, we're so honored that you were our guest this season, and you're about to kick off your West Coast tour tomorrow with a big show at the Triple Door. Would you honor us by playing a couple of songs for us?
I'd love to, yeah. This is about my grandmother's house in Kochi, the actual town that she lived in was called Miyanotani, which is it's on a creek, but the larger township is called Hidakamura, which means sunrise village, and I just always love that image. So this is called Hidakamura. Persimmons grow and fall.
come to call.
This next one is also about my grandmother. I used to visit her every summer when I was living in Japan, and then I moved to the U.S. when I was 8 years old, and then I couldn't see her as often, and then she sometime. When I was in middle school, she developed Alzheimer's, and each time I got to see her, it had progressed, and so she remembered less and less, and so I didn't really get to have like a last conversation with her before she died. But one day she appeared to me in a dream, and it was. So this is a song about her.
Would you feel the same?
would you know my name? There by the light of the cold, clear moon, there by the light of the afternoon,
musician Tomo Nakayama singing a song that he wrote for his grandmother. You're listening to a special live show we recorded in September 2022. Coming up, we'll hear some stories of objects submitted by our listeners. That's right after the break. What does it mean to live a good life? On the acclaimed podcast No Small Endeavor, produced by Great Feeling Studios and PRX, theology professor Lee C. Camp explores this question every week, sitting down with courageous and impassioned people from all walks of life, like Hollywood legend Rob Reiner and New York Times bestselling author Gretchen Rubin. Like our show, the podcast covers intimate stories from the past and future, from conversations on cultural Korean beauty standards with TED Talk's daily host, Elise Hu, to discussions on how our religious differences should be treasured with Interfaith America founder, Eboo Patel. Together, they'll figure out what it means to find true happiness and how we can all flourish in our day-to-day life. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts. KOW's community engagement team put out a call to our listeners, asking them to share their unique objects and the stories behind them. We received several submissions. This story is from listener Jesus Torres. His object was a truck that belonged to his father. It was a little too big to bring to the show, so he shared an image of it projected on a big screen on the stage. Here's Jesus at our live event describing the truck.
So this is my dad's 1973, and the year is really important because it was the first year that the square body came out. 73 Chevy Cheyenne pickup, and the Cheyenne was a nicer model, right? and it's a camper deluxe edition, which means it has a specialized transmission and stronger suspension to kind of carry the weight of a camper. And it has the slider on the back so that when the camper's on there, you can go in and out of the cab and to the camper without having to get out of the truck. So, that's my dad's truck.
So tell me about how that truck came into your father's life and later your life.
So I think the story of the truck is kind of like a boy meets girl story. My dad grew up very poor on a ranch outside of a small town in Jalisco, Mexico. And my mom grew up in the same town. That's where they met. And even though she was kind of socially, economically out of his league, they still fell in love. But he realized that if he was going to be able to provide for her, he was going to have to seek opportunities elsewhere because there was just not much there. He came to the United States through a guest worker program. And after several years of working, he landed a position as a foreman on a farm in Prosser, Washington. And this was huge because for him, it finally gave him legal, permanent legal status here in the United States. It was a stable job that he was going to hold on to and stay with. And it paid enough that he could go and buy this really nice brand new truck. So yeah, he bought it new, not used, not later on. He bought it in 73, new from the dealer. And so it's kind of, a big deal for him. And then as soon as he bought it, my mom says it wasn't even a week, but he drove down to Mexico met with, to go see my mom. And then he told her one afternoon, hey, let's go for a drive. In Mexican culture, se la robó. The drive didn't end until they got back to Washington. Now they're, me and my sisters are here now. And I guess it's a boy meet girl story, but really the story is the culmination of all their hard work, all their struggle, for him to finally say, I've made it. This is my moment in buying this truck. And then also for them, they finally got to start their life together after being apart for so long.
So you inherited this truck some years ago, or how did it, pass on to you?
So, I grew up with the truck. It's older than I am, obviously. And so, I think the growing up with the truck, my dad, I remember him always working hard on it, trying to take care of it. It was his pride and joy. I remember how frustrated he would get with me when he would try to teach me how to maintain it and I wasn't paying attention or whatever it might be. And then I remember we would take it every summer. We would drive to Mexico and we would spend our whole summer vacation, my two sisters and I and my parents in Mexico. And we did all the Mexican stuff while we were down there. But to me, the funnest parts were when we were on the road because we threw our luggage in the back of the bed and put a board and a mattress on top of that under the canopy, and we would drive down there. And I mean, to me, those were the funnest times. I remember driving over these giant tarantulas in Mexico, staying in hotels where there were scorpions in the bathtub for some reason. I think my parents did that on purpose just to mess with us. Just sitting on the tailgate with my sisters, eating Fruit Loops. I remember they were the old Fruit Loops that were actually good. But we would be eating them at the weirdest times of the day because the milk was getting warm in the cooler, so we had to use it before it went. That was the funnest times of my life, and because it was just the five of us together. And then later, so he passed away in 96, and the truck kind of just, we didn't drive it. It was just sad, right? So it kind of sat in my mom's driveway and fell into disrepair for a while. And then after I graduated from the UW and started working and kind of had my little I made it moment, I guess, I talked to her and I said, well, hey, what if we, you and I, we start working on fixing it up. And So that's kind of how I got the truck, was working with her to try to restore it a little bit. You know, that's kind of been the second phase, I guess, of how important this is to me. There's all the joy and the fun from when we were little, but now I spent time with my mom, and she told me about, not on purpose, not to guilt trip me, because she's actually really good at giving guilt trips when she wants to, but when we would be talking about what are we going to do, the truck, you know, she would just go into these stories about things that they experienced, and you know, a lot of the bad stuff too, some of the struggles, you know, but yeah, somehow the, you know, going from do you still want to have it green and white to, and her telling me about how, well, I never really liked it, but I never told your dad that. So we painted it silver because we both like this song called La Camioneta Gris. So kind of talking with her though, and going through those types of decisions of like, what are we gonna do next? She would just tell me about stories about the truck. And yeah, I think this part of it now is very difficult for me, because it's through, not on purpose, but she tells me all the struggles and everything that they went through. And, you know, I find myself wondering, do we deserve this, everything that they did? Are we worthy of their sacrifices? So it's just like pressure, I think, as a you know, child of an immigrant, to am I doing enough to pass on culture to my kids? Probably not. I know not enough. You know, could I ever work as hard as they did? Probably not. But you know, I guess I at the same time try to embrace it and try to do my part, and every now and then I'll hear some things on my Pandora mix where maybe it's the algorithm, but really I do think it's my dad looking down saying, hey, you're doing okay. I mean, there literally, the song plays now, it's called La Cheyenne, but I like to think there's something else there. And I really appreciate everything you guys are doing, because, you know, I guess I'm a little sentimental about things, and I just love how people can connect with those memories and those, you know, like the abacus and like the steering wheel on the truck. It's still greasy, but it's the same grease that he drove the truck with, so.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming tonight and sharing that story, Jesus, and coming with your family. So we have one more listener story from Deb Wong, who is a KUW on-air personality.
Wow, that is a tough act to follow. I need a moment, I think. This is going to feel very pedestrian after everything that we've heard tonight, but my object is my watch. It's a black plastic Timex Iron Man watch. And I first bought some version of this watch back in the 1980s when I got my first job right out of college. And I was a public radio reporter, and I needed something to keep the time, to wake me up in the morning, and I needed a stopwatch so that I could time my stories. And this watch did all three of those things. And believe me, this was high tech back in the 80s, right? So before I tell you about why it's important to me, I need to give you a little bit of backstory about me. So I am the youngest child of Chinese immigrants, and they came here in the 50s. And they practiced what I now realize was a sort of radical form of assimilationism. So, you know, we grew up not living amongst Chinese people. We didn't have many Chinese friends. All the kids, we didn't go to Chinese school on Saturdays. We basically didn't even speak Chinese because my parents were afraid that we would have accents. So that left me growing up feeling quite lost culturally and also really desperate to find some kind of identity. So In college, I really went sort of whole hog to find my roots, and I studied Mandarin, and I majored in East Asian history. And then I spent junior year living in China, teaching and studying Chinese. And this was in the early 80s, so it was just as China was opening up. Not many foreigners were living there. And I went to ridiculous lengths to try to fit in. So I bought Chinese clothing, you know, cotton, head to toe, including my shoes. I wore a braid. And the irony was that most Chinese women at the time really wanted to wear, you know, polyester and perm their hair. But I wanted to be like more Chinese than the Chinese. So fast forward a few years, and I end up back in Asia as a reporter for NPR as their Asia correspondent based in Hong Kong. And one day, so here's the story. One day, NPR sends me on a story. I don't even remember which one. And so I'm getting on the airplane. There's a seat next to me, and a Chinese gentleman sits down. And before I even sort of have a chance to say hello, he looks at me and says, "American, right?" So like, I'm a little bit taken aback because I literally had not even opened my mouth. And I said, "Yes, I'm American, but how did you know?" So he pointed at my wrist and he said, "It's your watch. Only Americans wear plastic watches." And he proceeds to pull out his watch, and of course he's wearing a beautiful gold Rolex. And he says, "These are the kind of watches that Chinese people wear." So as we sat there comparing watches, the sort of absurdity of this kind of hits me for the first time, that here I am trying to pass. And yet the contrast here is quite astounding. Like, I would never wear a gold Rolex watch. First of all, I couldn't afford one. And secondly, it just wasn't me, right? It wasn't me. I mean, I'm like the black plastic watch kind of person. So I think the reason I think about this is it was sort of, I don't know, it took me a long time to sort of stop being so serious about trying to fit in and trying to be the Chinese person who I thought I should be. And maybe that was kind of the beginning of me realizing I should just not take myself so seriously and just relax, right, into who I was. And so they still make this watch, and it still keeps time and it still wakes me up in the morning. And I should have timed this story because I think I've gone over a little bit. But you know, nowadays, if someone asks me like, "Well, what is your cultural identity?" I would say something like, you know, "I'm Chinese American. I'm the daughter of immigrants. I grew up in the Midwest. I married into the Pacific Northwest. I lived for a long time in Asia, and eventually I came home." And all of those things are true, and they're all okay with me right now. So thank you.
Deb, I actually heard that senior editor Jim Gates has the same watch. Thank you to Deb and Jesus for sharing their stories about what's meaningful to them and to everyone who submitted a story to us. As we close out our event, I wanted to thank all of you for listening to and supporting The Blue Suit. This podcast is a labor of love created by so many talented people. I'm really grateful to my producer, Whitney Henry Lester, who is cloistered up in the booth. So, you know, big round of applause for her. Thank you, Whitney. And to my editor, Jim Gates, for giving The Blue Suit its unique sound and feel. Thank you, Jim. Our production team included Michaela Giannotti, Teo Popescu, Amelia Peacock, Melissa Takai, and Hans Twite. Thank you also to Brendan Sweeney and to Matt Martin and Caroline Chamber Gomez for contributing to the pilot. Our events team tonight was Charlotte Duren, Kamna Shastri, Jordan House, and Robert Jacob Springer. I also want to thank Paul Kikuchi, my guest on episode 7, for curating the playlist that you heard at the beginning of tonight's program. I also want to say thank you to our community partners, again, South Seattle Emerald, International Examiner, the Wing League Museum, and my friends at Sassafras Boutique in Belltown for helping us with the mannequin tonight. Most of all, I want to thank all of the amazing people who shared their stories with me this season, my guests, and to every one of you who listened to and came out to support the Blue Suit tonight. Tomo is going to close out this program with his song, Roscoe.
And as a special surprise, Shen Yi is going to sing with me on this one. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share our stories, and it's been amazing. Stretch out and wait.
That's Tomo Nakayama singing his song Roscoe with a little backup help from me. That was from our live event at McCall Hall at the Seattle Center in 2022. A new season of 10,000 Things kicks off on April 30th, 2024. We've got some amazing stories to share with you, so please keep an eye on your feed. I'm Xinyi Pai. Thanks for listening.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.